W. Parkside, and Jane Herring, a former marketing manager at Gateway Technical College. Community Matters shares its time slot with the WGTD Radio Theater. And now, here's today's program.
Good morning. This is Len Iquinta for Community Matters, and our topic this morning is what's going on in medicine, particularly with respect to the pandemic and advances in predictive medical analytics. That's a mouthful. And the reason we're doing this is because there's going to be some free lectures being given next week, Saturday at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, as part of a program of the College of Natural and Health Sciences at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. They've got some scientists coming who will speak to the public virtually. You can attend and listen for free next week, Saturday afternoon, starting at 2 p.m. And to find out more about this and the topics that were going to be presented and the speakers, I'm talking to the current Dean of the College of Natural and Health Sciences at Parkside, Dean Emmanuel Otu. Good morning, Dean Otu.
Good morning, Len, and thank you for inviting me.
Tell us, what is this a part of? This is an annual event, is it not? And you will always have some really interesting speakers, and it's really great that the public can attend from any point in the world, and especially, of course, here in our listening area. Tell us what this is all about, Dean Otu.
Glad to. Through some reorganization within the academic section of the University of Wisconsin Parkside in 2012, the College of Natural and Health Sciences became a unit of its own, and we started this annual event just about 2 years after that. So this is our seventh event that we are having. Ordinarily, we will have had this in person on campus. And people come, there is food, there is lecture, there is science to share. But because of the COVID-19 pandemic, we did the sixth online, and we are doing this seventh one online. So the idea is to present topical issues within the society in a way that it's not really science-laden, in a way that the ordinary person can understand what is going on and apply it to their own personal lives and the decisions that they make. So that is what this program is all about.
Well, the past speakers we've had over the years have been terrific, and I need to disclose that I'm a member of the advisory board that has helped sponsor this event, and it was sort of the progenitor of this event, along with the faculty and staff of the university. Dean Otu, our listeners probably aren't aware of the programs, the academics that are within the College of Natural and Health Sciences. Maybe you could tell us what those majors are. And I know you have degrees both at the baccalaureate and the master's level. So if you could briefly review those, I think it would help our listeners understand what's available here at our local regional public university.
Thank you, Len. I think that's important for the people who are in our community, because they don't have to go too far for them to find what they are looking for. And I will try to list the programs that we have, the majors, alphabetically as much as possible. The first being our applied health sciences. So the applied health science degree has a group of concentrations within them that will lead students to towards the pre-med or pre-pharmacy or pre-veterinarian or pre-physician assistance program. That's within the Bachelor of Science in Applied Health Sciences. It's up to the student, the choice that they want to make within that, depending on their interest. Then we have the Biological Sciences, within which we have the typical biology degree, and then a Molecular Biology and Bioinformatics degree for those students who really want to go into research into some of the genome and cell, you know, related to cell biology. Then we have chemistry, environmental studies, we have geosciences, we have health information management and technology, which is a degree completion program. You have to have 60 credits from elsewhere before you come into the program, or if you don't have 60 credits, we can help you get those 60 credits before you get into the program. And that program, after the first 60 credits, it's 100% online. So you have to do it at home. Then we have mathematics, physics, kinesiology, sports management. The sports management degree has a bachelor degree and a master's degree. We have psychology, and within the psychology department, we have a master's degree in clinical mental health counseling, which leads to licensure through the Wisconsin Department of Public Safety, Department of Public Safety, DPS. You can get a license to practice as a therapist or a counselor. Then we have health and wellness management master's degree, which is online, sustainable management at the bachelor's degree, and also master's degree, both of those are online as well. Okay. So those are just some of the array of programs that we have within the college.
And folks who are wanting to do a physical therapy careers also could begin their studies at your college too, couldn't they?
Yes, they can start at the college and get their pre-physical therapy degree.
Well, that's really very, very informative, and I appreciate it. Now, at this event, it's called an alumni and community event. Everyone is welcome to tune in, and they can tune in next week, Saturday afternoon at 2:00. And you want people to register to get the link, and they can do that by going online. I know the easiest way I do is into Google. I just type in CNHS Parkside Alumni Community Event 2021, and it pops right up. Is there another way that we should tell people to register for this event so they can hear these speakers free?
That is the right way to do it, Len.
That's the simplest way, I think, just to Google it. Now, let's go briefly. We've got a few minutes here to go over who the speakers are. One of the speakers, the next one that I'll be speaking to on this program, is Dr. John Raymond. He's the president and CEO of the Medical College of Wisconsin, and he's going to talk about how they're coping with COVID-19 and what it's like to manage a healthcare system. We're also going to be hearing from Dr. Jennifer Freiheit, the director of the Kenosha County Division of Health. She's going to talk about managing public health in the midst of a pandemic. And we're going to also hear from Dr. Russell Roberson, who's the Vice President of Quality, Regulatory, Patient Safety, and Data Governance for Elsevier. And he's going to be talking about just a fascinating subject, and he has a great title, The Medical Science of Star Trek Becomes Reality with Predictive Analytics in Healthcare. Dr. Otu, could you take a minute or two to tell us a little bit more about these speakers and why they were selected, sir?
I said at the beginning that we look at what are the topical issues in the society at that time that we're having this event. So when we looked at what is happening now, of course, COVID is what is happening. And we needed to assemble people who will inform the community very sufficiently about the research that has gone on before even the COVID hit. We knew that COVID-19 was going to be around. So Dr. Raymond is going to be talking about the history of research that led to the production of vaccines. And I know a lot of people are concerned about the mRNA, virus production process. He's going to let us know how long this research has been in place. Dr. Freiheit is going to talk about public health, especially with the school system, bringing kids back to school and how that is being managed at the public health level. And of course, you mentioned the fascinating topic that Dr. Roberson has. Well, he's a fan of Star Trek and he wants to connect that to it. And he will let us know exactly that Star Trek, what they predicted was going to be the way that medicine will move in the future.
Well, that's terrific. Thank you so much for that introduction and understanding of what we're about to hear in the rest of the program. And now we'll start to hear from those speakers, and they're going to give us a little brief teaser about what their full topic is going to be about. And now I'm going to turn to the keynoter for the CNHS Alumni and Community event on October 16th. And he is John R. Raymond Sr., MD. He's the president and CEO of the Medical College of Wisconsin. Dr. Raymond leads Wisconsin's only private medical school with an operating budget of more than $1.2 billion. More than half of Wisconsin physicians are grads of the Medical College of Wisconsin. Dr. Raymond is a practicing nephrologist who plays active roles in clinical care, teaching, and faculty mentorship. Dr. Raymond also is a medical researcher studying the basic mechanisms of kidney cell function. Welcome and good morning, Dr. Raymond.
Thank you. Good morning, Len.
Now, your keynote presentation at the College of Natural and Health Sciences event is on COVID-19 pandemic. That's a very broad subject, but let me ask you a few questions and give our listeners a preview of what they're going to hear if they're smart enough to tune into the whole event on 2 o'clock next Saturday. Tell us, what is your overview of where we are now with the COVID-19 pandemic, Doctor?
Yeah, thanks, Len. We're in the middle of the fourth or the fifth wave of COVID-19, depending on your locality and how you count the various surges. And this one is different. It's being driven by a more contagious and possibly a more severe variant of COVID-19 called the Delta variant. So where we are now at the beginning of October is it looks like we're starting to peak and maybe hit a plateau here in Wisconsin. We're a few weeks behind the rest of the country. They've already started to decelerate in other localities, but it's still going to remain a challenge for us through the remainder of this calendar year.
Now, I'm a masker. There are a lot of people who don't mask, and depending on what county I'm in, Kenosha County, Racine County, Lake County, it's bewildering, all the differences. If you were advising your children, your adult children, what would you tell them that they should be doing to keep themselves safe?
Thank you. And obviously, this is a controversial and in some cases emotional topic, but the facts really do support masking as one potential layer of mitigation for COVID-19. The problem with masking really is that the more people that wear masks and wear them properly, the better the effect. And in many cases, people don't believe that masks work because of misinformation or disinformation that they've heard about from friends or on social media. But we really do need that as one of the hallmarks of an effective strategy to get on the other side of the pandemic.
There was an article published just about a week ago in the New York Times that talked about the what you could call the escalating variants of the COVID-19 virus, in that they are becoming, they seem to be learning to be more transmissible. Could you comment on that? And how real of a fear is that? And what can that portend for the future?
Right. Well, first of all, let's not be afraid of COVID-19. Let's be smart about how we deal with it. None of us want to live in fear, but it is natural for viruses to mutate. Every time they infect a person and replicate, they have the opportunity to change themselves. And it is natural in the course of viral evolution for the virus to try to be more transmissible so that it can spread from person to person more easily. And so that is what's happening with COVID-19. And the most transmissible variant so far is this Delta variant that has been driving this fourth or fifth surge that we've had. There is the potential that if we don't get COVID-19 under control, that there may be an even more transmissible and potentially more severe variant that emerges. And that is one of my concerns. Not only do we need to get the United States vaccinated, but really the entire world, so that we can minimize the likelihood of a new variant that's more difficult to control that emerging in the future.
Dr. Raymond, as you look at the situation as it evolves in the United States in general, and if you want to talk about Wisconsin in particular and Illinois, that'd be fine. What do you see as the trajectory? You say we're in a fourth or fifth wave. What causes these waves? Why are we speaking of waves?
That's such a good question, and there's no simple answer, Len. Viruses and other infectious organisms do run a course when they're in a pandemic situation or an epidemic where there's a surge. And then after a while, the people that are most likely to be infected, either by the risks they have from where they live or how they work or their personal behavior or pre-existing medical conditions, already are infected. And so there is a natural waxing and waning that happens with contagious diseases. What's been difficult about this pandemic is we haven't had an integrated national strategy. It's become highly politicized when we try to do interventions that rely either on policy changes or personal responsibility to mitigate the virus. And the virus has mutated into more contagious and more difficult to contain variants. And so that's the reason why we have this waxing and waning of the virus.
A lot of people are confused because of different advice. I think some of the newscasters are more confused than they need to be because they haven't been paying close attention, in my opinion. But I used to be a student of the history of science, and I have a very scientific bent to me. It seems to me that we're following a natural course of, as you learn more, you get new ideas about what's right and what's wrong as you accumulate more evidence. Do you want to just talk a little bit about that scientific method and maybe explain to our listeners why they're experiencing different advice, different months, different times?
Yeah, thank you, Len. I think it's so important for us to learn that anything that we believe we know is based on the evidence and the facts available to us at that moment in time, and that as we go forward, the virus may change and our understanding of the virus also will grow and hopefully become more precise and more correct. And that has been a problem with the politicization of these mitigation measures. I still hear people say that what we thought we knew back in February of 2020 is wrong, and it was. We've learned more. Or other people believe that what they heard a year ago still applies, and that isn't necessarily the case. Science is clearly an iterative process. Another problem is information is so widely available now, it's not very well curated, and people have difficulty understanding who should be a trusted source and a trusted voice. And that also has been a problem with the explosion of misinformation on social media, but also mainstream media. I'm sure you know that for economic reasons, many newspapers and other media sources no longer employ a science expert.
Yes.
And also the propensity for headlines to be sensationalized, oversimplified, and that causes problems as well with people's basic understanding of the difficulty that we're having getting a grasp on the biology and the epidemiology of COVID-19.
Thank you, Doctor. Now, one more particular issue that I'd like to explore, Dr. Raymond, is of the science behind the vaccines. Some people are afraid that these are very new ideas and that nothing has been tested enough to really be sure, even though we've had millions of people vaccinated. Can you comment a little bit about your trust and that the science is really not all that novel?
Yeah, so thank you. It's really an important question. This mRNA technology has actually been around for over two decades, and it's been studied in many different, potential uses. Using it for vaccines also isn't a new idea, but this is the first time that we've deployed messenger RNA vaccines on a large scale. So I think that caused some hesitation for people. But really all we're doing is going one step further down the biological pathway that our body's normal immune system uses to generate antibodies and memory T and B cells that are the various limbs of our immune system to fight off the virus. And I'd also point out that 200 million people have received messenger RNA vaccines in the United States, and hundreds of thousands of people have had them for over a year. And so this isn't that different than the process that we normally use to approve vaccines. In fact, I would say that we've never had a more heavily studied and scrutinized vaccine technology than we do with these messenger RNA vaccines. And the message is there is no perfect drug and there is no perfect vaccine. There can be side effects, but they're actually quite rare. And when you compare the risk of a 2% mortality rate from COVID-19 and up to a third of the people that are recovering from COVID-19 having long-term potentially debilitating symptoms, the risk-benefit ratio is strongly in favor of getting vaccinated.
Thank you so much, Dr. Raymond, and we're looking forward to your full presentation in a week. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Len.
And now I'm going to turn to interviewing another one of the presenters at the event, Dr. Jennifer Freiheit. Dr. Freiheit has worked in state and local public health leadership roles since 2002, serving the southeastern region of Wisconsin. She is now the health officer for Kenosha County. She earned her doctorate in the Department of Administrative Leadership through the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Dr. Freiheit was the regional grant coordinator of 14 local public health departments with a combined staff of more than 400, and she led them to national recognition in emergency preparedness and response. Welcome, Dr. Freiheit, to Community Matters this morning.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Dr. Freiheit, you're going to be talking about the pandemic at the event next week, Saturday. Our listeners can tune into for free through the internet. Give us a little preview of what you're going to be talking about, please, Doctor.
Sure. Well, I'll be talking about how the COVID-19 pandemic has affected Kenosha County, how it has affected local public health departments, sort of talking about historical practice. We leaned a lot from the 1918 pandemic, how each novel disease outbreak means reinventing public health policy, how we were able to work with our epidemiology on the science of public health as a baseline to inform our decisions, and what that sort of meant as it impacted our work with all of the other 60 plus programs and services in the health department, and how we're managing to still give those services to the community while still being the incident commander and responding to this pandemic as it has not gone away.
Tell us some of the points you're going to make in your presentation, some of the highlights that people can expect to hear more fully discussed.
Yeah, it's going to be a bit of what has happened since the beginning of March 2020, what we did internally in the health department to prepare before we even had our first case. We were watching things happening overseas. We were watching as things were happening in Washington State and what we did, how we pivoted and shifted many times throughout 2020 in our response, pulling upon the science, the epidemiology, the historical perspective that we had, and how that informed our decisions up to this point where we are still struggling as public health in the nation to determine what is the best way to still mitigate this, to decrease the amount of hospitalizations and deaths. And so it'll be a little bit more of a personal, not personal on me, but personal on the health department account of what has happened, how we responded, and the impact that has had on public health workers that I think is often unknown. We're an unknown entity. It's really easy to know what police department and fire departments do in responses, but it's not always easy to understand what does a public health department do. And so giving a little bit of insight into the behind the scenes, what happens with a public health agency and how we respond to a massive pandemic.
Jennifer, what are the sources of information that you use? Dr. Freiheit, I wonder if people have an understanding of how you get information at the county level. Where do you get your information and where do you source the science?
Absolutely. So we're looking at hundreds of places daily. We often take full direction from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, the FDA. We look to our state health department. In addition, when it comes to a local health department, we are collaborating daily with our neighboring health departments. over the border in Illinois with the Lake County Health Department, Walworth and Racine, plus all of the health departments in Milwaukee County, sharing best practices, leaning on each other's data. We are always in Kenosha County about a week behind Chicago and Milwaukee. So we are looking at what's happening in those big cities. We pull from peer-reviewed journals. So we have a number of researchers in the health department and throughout the state, and we pull upon any peer-reviewed journals that are coming out. We read all the fine print, look at whether something was fully peer-reviewed or not, as opposed to, YouTube videos or misinformation. However, we do read that too, because we're constantly looking for what is the pulse of the community. So, we're looking at the business and economic impact. We're speaking with our CABA partners and other businesses where, it's not just a science, but we're hearing the qualitative data, if you will, the storytelling, the pulse of the community to inform our decisions as well too.
I hadn't thought of it in those terms before, but really public health, it's a science, but there's also an art to the science. It's an art and a science both, isn't it?
It is, and I've never quite said it that way, and I may steal that from you. So it is absolutely, it is public health. We don't do one-on-one patient care per se. I mean, we are here for the community. It's often called population health, and how we help our communities to achieve greater health access, reduce the health disparities, improve health equity. And so that informs all of our decisions. In fact, it's in our vision statement, how we look at equity to produce healthier futures. So really, it's the whole gamut. It's the whole picture, from quantitative to qualitative data to public policy to having political acumen and looking at all of those pieces to help best meet the needs of our community.
Public health at the county level is not a command and control operation. You don't reach conclusions and then just control everybody to have to fall in line and do what you recommend. So there's a lot of communication and persuasion and cajoling involved. Can you just give us a little idea about what is the power of a county health department official like yourself?
Well, correct. Before this coronavirus, we relied on state statute 252. So that was, it's basically the state statute that dictates a public health official's authority. Now, as you know, in May of 2020, those authorities got called into question, and that sort of changed what public health could do right in the middle of the pandemic. So while we're also utilizing best public health practices, we were forced to pivot to a new realm, a new world. I mean, the state statute's been in place for decades to sort of figure out, okay, now how do we protect the public without some of these powers that we had long utilized to ensure that somebody with tuberculosis wasn't in the community or somebody with measles was staying home. And we had long used that authority without question. And it was never a question of how a health official would abuse our powers, but clearly that came into question with this pandemic. And so it was a bit of how do we pivot so that the community can understand that we're here to protect them, but we are not here to dictate or abuse our statutory authority in any way. We do operate internally in a command and control structure. In any event, we operate within the incident command system. And that initially came out of the fire departments in California decades ago through FireScope on how an agency, whether it's a fire department, a police department, a sheriff's department, or a health department, can respond quickly and systematically to any type of emergency. So we have trained for 18 years, quite honestly, since 9/11, in how to operate within this incident command system. So internally, we can mobilize quickly, make decisions quickly, and do what we need to do to protect the public. But you're right. So I just wanted to clarify that little nuance. We do operate in a command and control structure internally so that we can formulate who's in charge of planning, who's in charge of logistics, who's in charge of operations. But you're right. As far as communicating to the public, it's a different game.
Yes. The political system is really in control to a great extent. Now, I remember back in the old days when I was a child and we had dinosaurs in Lake Michigan, when we had polio, we took all that very seriously, and we finally pretty much wiped out polio all over the world. It doesn't look like we're going to wipe out COVID-19 in the half a minute or so we have left, do you expect that COVID-19 is going to disappear anytime soon, Dr. Freiheit?
No, it will always be with us. The hope is that its virulence will keep diminishing and decreasing down to being a common cold, that we won't be as concerned about hospitalizations and deaths.
And where should people be looking for information about booster shots? What website would you tell them to go to, whether they've gotten Johnson, Moderna, or Pfizer?
Absolutely. So we always keep that information updated on the Kenosha County COVID website. You can just Google simply that, or you can go, if you know where the county website is, it's right at the top of the page that'll link you to our data dashboard, to all the testing sites, all of our vaccination sites. We keep that updated, and so that information is always out there. And we're always sharing press with the news, with Kenosha News, and that is how we keep people informed, as well as following our Facebook page.
Thank you, Dr. Freiheit. I'll be listening to hear all of the details from your presentation a week from today.
Great. Thank you so much.
And now I'm going to turn to my final guest, Dr. Russell Robertson. He's a PhD. He's the Vice President of Quality, Regulatory, Patient Safety, and Data Governance for Elsevier. Elsevier provides evidence-based content to improve clinical outcomes. He is a visiting professor at numerous universities, and Dr. Robertson is a licensed professional engineer and holds advanced degrees in both business and engineering. Well, I'm certainly impressed. Welcome, Dr. Robertson, to our program this morning.
Thank you, Lennon. Thanks for having me.
Now, your presentation at this public event at Parkside that we're going to be able to tune in to virtually at 2 o'clock a week from today is titled About the Medical Science of Star Trek and Predictive Medical Analytics, which is quite a topic. And you told me when we were chatting before the program that you have a 9-point checklist of things from the old Star Trek series, some dating back to the original air dates in the mid-60s, that have come true partially or completely. Do you want to tell us what those 9 are quickly? I was fascinated by that.
Well, sure, Lynn, I will. You know, let me start with just what some of those medical advances were back in the Star Trek series, and then I'll talk a little bit about how they've kind of promulgated or matriculated into the devices we have today, some which are as good as they had in the Star Trek series, and some which are, you know, not there yet, but are getting there. I think it's interesting to note that the Star Trek series as a total actually went from the Earth years 2151 to 3189. So we have a long time to go to actually get to some of these devices that are pretty amazing on these shows. I like these type of things, one, because I like how science fiction can turn into science fact. And here's a couple examples of this. So if you're a Star Trek fan, you might remember the mobile tricorder, which Dr. McCoy used when he could slide a device over top of you without touching you. And he could detect, you know, your temperature, things going on inside of your body, tumors, et cetera. But a non-invasive approach to actually understanding the medical conditions, and there could be some type of treatment that goes from there. We have that today in some areas, and I'll talk a little about it in a second. The hypospray was really neat. The hypospray in the Star Trek world was when you could inject drugs needleless, with no needles, into your body, straight into your body, either through the skin or, you know, in the Star Trek world, they could do that through uniforms and also into any alien skin they might have. So we don't have that. We don't have the alien thing down, we have to go directly into the skin. But Star Trek had that. They had the vital monitors that you saw all around them, people that were laying in the beds, and they also had, and you might remember, they had many different types of equipment that they could bring to the bedside and actually take care of patients. We do that today, so that you don't have to have patients go to a MRI room or a CT room. You can take care of them and do those type of operations, you know, right where they sit. The visor, which is LaForge's visual instrument and sensory organ replacement, where he was able to see even though he was blind. We don't have that. We don't have the totally blind, but there are devices out there now that for legally blind or partially blind individuals, they help improve their sights. And that's certainly something new. Telemedicine was all over Star Trek. I mean, they did that all over the place, you know, and through galaxies. So we could call it galactic telemedicine. But we do that today, and you've certainly seen that through areas like COVID and how we work through that. Interestingly enough, telemedicine was actually first predicted in 1925 in a small science magazine that looked at doing this through radio waves. So, you know, even if we go back farther, somebody on a radio show back in 1925 was probably saying, hey, one day we're going to get telemedicine, and look at it, 100 years later, we have that. A skin regenerator, now we do have that, but the skin regenerator that Dr. Crusher used in the Star Trek series was able to actually seal wounds, you know, without having to put sutures on with a laser. And she could also make sure the wounds had no scars afterwards. We can't do that, but we do have today dermal lasers where we can actually seal wounds without having to do sutures. 3D imaging is amazing. And I've worked in many different many different businesses in the healthcare industry. So I've had responsibility for like 3D MRI imaging that we can do now, where we can actually predict and know where tumors are in the body. We can actually give very specific locations to robotic surgeons. And one of the coolest things that they did in the Star Trek series is that most all their instruments were able to heal themselves. And I think that's really cool. They could tell when they were going to go bad. They knew things were going. They knew they had their tires rotated. They could schedule their own maintenance. They'd either do that electronically, you know, through a software download, or they would have someone come out and fix them. And we're doing that today too. So there's a lot of cool things that are going on in the medical industry. And a lot of those come from, you know, individuals, you know, little, you know, kids, scientists watching the Star Trek series and saying, hey, I think I can do that one day. And guess what? That science fiction becomes science fact.
Yeah, it's been fun to watch, Russ. It really has. Dr. Robertson, I know you have sort of a personal connection to some of these topics, and I know you can give us a little bit of a preview of what you're going to be doing next Saturday. Tell us a little bit deeper dive into some of these things that are so fascinating and related to this strange sounding concept of predictive analytical medicine.
Great. Well, let me start with talking a little bit about some things that we're doing now with high-risk pregnancies, and then I'll kind of link that back to some of my personal experiences in healthcare. But when predictive analytics, what we're trying to do is we're trying to take input from multiple devices, population health, data where we can get it, pull that together, and make an inference about a population and apply it to a specific person, like you, and apply it specifically to you, okay? And that's hard to do. But if we can do that, then we can get better treatment plans for individuals. We can have better outcomes, you know, as much as their health will allow. And hopefully, you know, it's going to be a less stressful healthcare experience. One of the wonderful things that's happening in the industry right now is something with high-risk pregnancies in very rural areas of the world. So like in the United States, we have a pretty low infant mortality and maternal mortality rate. And, you know, that's good for us. But that's not the case everywhere in the world where women cannot have access to hospitals or doctors or things like that. It is important in a lot of those situations, the people that treat them may not have medical training. So one of the things predictive analytics does, and we're doing now, is we're actually gearing a set of questions and data to the talent of the individual who's observing the woman or working with the woman as their professional to be able to determine if the pregnancy is a high risk. And if it is a high risk, what are the expectations of the pregnancy? Will there be a rupture that occurs? Will there be a problem with the child when it's born? All preventive care so that you can actually prevent those high-risk pregnancies from matriculating, and done in such a way that everyone can understand. So for example, I'm not a medical doctor, Lynn. So if you were to communicate to me medical terms on a high-risk pregnancy, I would not be able to do that. But we can actually talk to the individual who's given the care in a language they can understand. They can communicate to that person, and we can have that medical treatment there, and the outcome's pretty good. And that's a wonderful thing for us to do. But it really requires us, you know, being able to predict at an individual level based on a population of data how we think an individual person will react. Now, at the end of all this, and all in end of all predictive analytics, is a doctor or a nurse or someone with medical professional. So not everything's perfect. And in some cases, you know, the medical professionals have to step outside the predictive analytics and make a decision that's good for the patient. And the reason I mentioned that is a good example of that from the Star Trek universe is Dr. Phlox. Dr. Phlox in Star Trek universe was the only one that was able to actually cure a Borg mind assimilation. It's a very hard thing to do. It's not easy. And he had to step outside his predictive analytics tools to do that. So in some cases, you know, we depend on the medical professional to say, hey, that's really a good try, but I need to do something in a little different way. Now, my personal connection to all this, and I think this is important to me, and it affects me dearly, is I've actually had cancer twice, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So I've had many, many chemotherapies, many surgeries, many radiation treatments. And I will tell you that I have sat on both the design side, the manufacturing side and the executive sponsor side of many of these devices, and on the patient side. And it's different. It's different on both sides. I can sit back as a scientist and say, hey, these predictive analytic tools are just amazing. Trust them. They're going to work. And I sat on the patient side that says, whoa, do I really want to trust those engineers and scientists to make a prediction about my health, about me, based upon data that doesn't always include me? And it's difficult, but at the end of the day, the science is very good and the outcomes are very good. And so I always tell people, you know, that there may be some uncertainty, but more than likely, you're going to do better by trusting the predictive analytics tools that we have in medicine.
And it's better for your physician and healthcare personnel to have that information rather than being blind, as we've been in the past.
That's exactly right. So they always have a choice to act differently. They're the medical professionals. They get the last say, okay? But what this does is give them options they may not have considered, or may give them a direction to move in that supports what they're thinking about doing. But more importantly, it gives them a prediction method. So if we certainly know, like in a high-risk pregnancy, that we expect a rupture, you know, in the delivery, that's something they're going to want to know beforehand, even if it doesn't come true. If there's a 97% chance of a rupture, they can be prepared for that. Okay. And so that helps them, you know, I think probably eases the stress they have, you know, during the delivery process.
Any other items that you think I'll be particularly interested in the 3 minutes or so we have left, Russ?
Well, you know, I think that, yeah, there are probably a few here that I could go through. I tell you, the predictive analytics process, you know, is really fairly complex. And I think that's one of the things that we have to realize is that it's not something that happens easily. It takes a good amount of time. And we really have to have very good data collection techniques. We have to have very good clinical trials. It's not something that happens overnight, okay? And as part of that, the predictive analytics process is a living process, which means that this is our population changes, is our culture changes, is our environment changes, is how we eat changes, all those type of things that happen. You know, we have to take that into effect. And when we feed the predictive analytics model with data, which means that the data we have today may not be the data we use tomorrow. There's an expiry date on the data we use in predictive analytics. And, you know, you can just see that, you know, relative to how our population has changed over the last 10 to 20 years, getting a little taller, maybe in some cases getting a little wider. Okay. But the key is that the data we have today and the way we eat, the way we drink, all those type of things have to be factored into the predictive analytics tools. The Star Trek universe is cool for me. I've always been a science fiction fan, because when you look at what goes on in Star Trek and any other science fiction process, you know, you look at those type of things. And as a scientist, you say, that's really neat. I wonder if I can do that. I wonder if I can actually make that happen. Well, I can tell you, Len, that I've actually built a few of these myself just to have fun. I actually have a transporter in my home, which does not work. So I've not been able to transport myself from there to the grocery store, anything like that. But those are the type of things that science fiction inspires. You just say, that's really cool. A really creative mind and an innovative mind came up with that series, came up with the science fiction, and the scientists go make that happen. And that's what's really fun. And in my case, you make it happen for the betterment of mankind. And that's really special.
Dr. Robertson, just really a lightning round question. Where do you think we're going to be in 30 years? How fast do you think things are changing? I'll give you 20 seconds.
I think very fast. And I think it's really going to be a focus on how quickly we can get the data. One of the things data analytics has to have is data. So I think we have to be a little bit more open with our data and how we share data, you know, as individuals. Like for me, you can have as much of my data as you want to help, you know, predictive analytics makes good predictions. But a lot of people don't feel that way. A lot of people are very sensitive on how their data is used or not used.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And thank you to all of our guests this morning on Community Matters. This program, which is free and open to the public, is being conducted by the College of Natural and Health Sciences of the University of Wisconsin Parkside. And you can hear it for free and watch it next week, Saturday afternoon, beginning at 2 p.m. In order to register, Google CNHSUW Parkside Alumni Event October, and it'll pop right up. I'll be there too. For Community Matters, this is Len Iaquinta urging you to get informed and get involved. Have a good day.
You've been listening to Community Matters. All programs are archived at WGTD.org. Click shows. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.
Support comes from Kenosha County ADRC, now